You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, this is Tim McMaster taking you around the National League East for MLB.com Extras. We're a few days after the trade deadline now. Time to catch you up on who is buying and who is selling and what players have new homes. Let's start at the top of the National League East with our MLB.com Nationals reporter, Bill Ladson. Bill, Nationals on an upswing right now. A nice road trip for this team. Obviously, the sweep of the Diamondbacks, but the Diamondbacks are a team having a rough season. But before that, they go to Cleveland and San Francisco. Those are two tough stops on a road trip, and they come out of that end of it 3-3 before sweeping the Diamondbacks. So you take the whole thing together, and that's a solid trip in an important time of the season. What stood out to you from that road trip for this team?
Well, I mean, what stood out to me was that, they played tough against Cleveland and San Francisco. I mean, I still think, to me, beating the Diamondbacks, that's not a real test. I think the real test will be when they play the Giants again this weekend. And I think this will show me that the Nationals are for real and they're on their way to winning a championship. So I think they still have a lot to prove to me. And I think winning in Cleveland and winning in San Francisco, I think I still need more to see that they're a World Series team.
Absolutely. Now, when we talked last week, Bill, I had the thought that, hey, Aroldis Chapman's off the board. There's no way the Nationals are going to end up finding a closer on this trade market because I didn't think they would be willing to give up what it would take to get Andrew Miller. But, hey, they surprised me. They go out, they get Mark Melancon, a guy that I didn't think the Pirates would be willing to trade since they're still in the race. But kudos to the Nationals. They get their closer in Melancon, a guy who's been great the last couple of years. And they didn't give up too much to get him. Were you surprised at all that they were able to do this at the deadline?
Yes, I was surprised. And more so, I was surprised that the Pirates gave up. I thought they were still in the race, as you said. But, Mike Rizzo has been this way since he's been the GM. Most of his deals are one-sided. And it's going to be interesting to see if Felipe Rivero and Taylor Hearns, are really productive in Pittsburgh. I mean, Taylor Hearns is still an A-ball, and Rivero had an up-and-down season. So I think that's a wait-and-see on the Pirates' part. On the Nationals' part, I think that they did well. But I still think they needed more. I mean, I think getting Melancon was great, but I still think they still need some bullpen help because, they don't have any lights-out type of pitchers. I mean, other than Melancon, I guess. But that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, it's not a bullpen that you're afraid of when you get to the late innings. The good thing for the Nationals is at least they have a starting rotation that has a good amount of that in it, and hopefully those guys can go deep. How about the Melancon and Papelbon, chemistry and these two guys being in that bullpen together?
Well, so far so good, but again, after a week, I got to wait and see. I mean, I got to see if Papelbon is really going to take this well. So far, he's taking it well. He said he's going to be a team player, but then again, I got to wait and see because this is a guy who wanted to break Mariano Rivera's saves record. He said that when he first joined the Nationals. And I just hope that we don't see what happened last year when Papelbon came along and Drew Storen just lost it. So it was a mental thing with him. So, I'm not going to praise anything until I see it until the end.
Yeah, we will certainly have to wait and see. And Papelbon, I mean, at the end of the day, you look at the numbers, and I don't think they were the numbers that a team that wants to win a World Series can look down at their closer and be happy with. So, I mean, you would hope he can be honest with himself as well and see that. But we will see. It'll be an interesting way the rest of the way. And, hey, that's why Dusty Baker's here, right, to smooth over all those things. Wednesday, they finish off the sweep of the Diamondbacks, Bill, and Scherzer was great again, 11 strikeouts over eight innings. It took a while before the Diamondbacks even got a hit. Now, that's not a potent lineup necessarily right now, but early in that game, did Scherzer have that look like he does sometimes that he might be able to take a no-hitter deep into the game?
All the time. I mean, it seems, when I saw first four innings, I said, oh, no, he's going to pitch a no-hitter.
Yeah.
And then, but you know what, though? I think this guy is a true ace. And you know what? Everyone's making a big deal about the home runs he's given up. But it's not, to me, that's not a big deal, Tim. I mean, I look at when I was growing up, Cassius Hunter, Bird Blyleven, those guys gave up a lot of home runs, but they still won their share of games. They still won Cy Young's in Cassius Hunter's case. I just think that's not a big deal. It really isn't. And I can understand if he gave up a ton of hits, like singles, doubles, triples. But they're just home runs. And I just think this guy is just an ace. Scherzer is.
Todd, the trade deadline has come and gone, and very different from a year ago. The Phillies end up staying quiet. It's something that you had talked a lot about, I think, over the last month, the fact that this team didn't feel like it had to make any moves. There were no players that had to get dealt before, you know, to get something back in return. The one guy that it seemed like the rumors continued to kind of swirl around, maybe till the end, was Jeremy Hellickson. But nothing ever seemed to really be developing around Hellickson. At the end of the day, was it just teams weren't offering enough for Hellickson, or did the Phillies just decide, hey, we want this guy on our roster the rest of the year?
Well, I definitely think it was more of the Phillies did not like the return that they were necessarily getting for Jeremy Hellickson, because while certainly, you know, having Jeremy Hellickson in the rotation now and possibly in the future is beneficial, I don't think if you talk to anybody in the front office candidly, they would say that that was their end game. Because they would just come out and say, listen, we love Jeremy Hellickson. We'll have to be totally blown away to trade him. It certainly was not that situation. So, but that said, I was definitely surprised that he was not traded. I think there are some risks in not trading him, you know, going the next season. His stock might never be higher than it is right now. And, you know, most importantly, as well as he is pitched and as good as he is in the clubhouse, I don't think Matt Quintat looks at Jeremy Hellickson as a piece of this team's future, you know, 2-3 years down the road when they're competitive again.
Yeah, and I was a little surprised just by the fact that you saw what the price was for starting pitching, what other teams gave up for Matt Moore and Drew Pomerantz. The Red Sox parted with a high-end, really their best pitching prospect at the time. You saw for that starting role, really good prospects going the other way, but maybe Jeremy Hellickson just didn't fit that in other teams' minds in that they were willing to part ways with them. And then the Phillies have to be honest with themselves, I think, and say, hey, look what other teams are getting for their starting pitching. We don't want to get ripped off here.
Well, yeah. Certainly if they were totally lowballed and, you know, given some middling double-A reliever that, you know, is a one in a million shot to be a mop up guy in the big leagues. Yeah, then it makes no sense to trade Jeremy Hellickson. But you know, the interesting thing is, I think what the Phillies were judging all the talent that they were being offered to was based off a potential draft pick if they make him a qualifying offer after the season. And I would say right now it's almost a lock that they make him a qualifying offer. So the Phillies were looking at it like this. If we make Jeremy Hellickson a qualifying offer, we're almost positive that he's going to reject it. He's going to sign a multi-year contract with another team. And if that happens, if he rejects a qualifying offer and signs elsewhere, the Phillies will get a compensation pick between the first and second round. So the Phillies were looking at it going, okay, we need to get talent in return that is equivalent to, say, the 35th overall pick in next year's draft, which I understand. It makes sense. But the big difference there, in my opinion, is there's a prospect, obviously, is much further along in his professional career. He's easier to project. A draft pick, while valuable, is still just a draft pick. I mean, how many times do you see first-rounders flame out, second-rounders flame out, you know, and a late, you know, 20th-round pick becomes a superstar? So it's definitely a gamble on the Phillies' part to maybe hold out for something what they consider to be better than a compensation pick. Again, knowing that a prospect is, in my opinion, more valuable because he's closer to the big leagues, he's got a longer track record, and that pick is definitely a risk.
Yeah, I guess the pressure then falls on the scouting department now to, hey, you got to capitalize on this compensation pick that they should be getting. All right, so you have to then look ahead to the rest of the season, and obviously there's a lot of players that are kind of knocking on the door for this Phillies team, Todd, and you'd think at some point we're going to see some of them. I think the quote, though, from Matt Klentak was, there's a decent chance we'll see prospects the rest of the way, which I thought was funny. But I mean, J.P. Crawford, Nick Williams, Jake Thompson, there's guys down there. In your mind, does one of those jump out as the first guy that could get the call?
Well, what's actually even more interesting about Klintak's comment is he used it in the singular. He said, I expect there might be a first-time big league prospect will be called up at some point. He didn't say prospects, which has me wondering. So I think if it might just be one guy, I think it's going to be Jake Thompson because, you know, they're monitoring Vince Velasquez's innings this season. Aaron Nola has really struggled. So, you know, Zach Eflin, they might want to cut back to protect his arm. So they might try to stretch those guys out a little bit or protect those guys and call up Jake Thompson at some time. So I still think that Jake Thompson is going to get a promotion. He is by far the most worthy of a promotion of all the Phillies' top prospects. He has pitched. He has been absolutely ridiculously good over his last 8 or 9 starts, an ERA of about 1.5, maybe even a shade under that. And Nick Williams and J.P. Crawford are the other two guys you mentioned, and fans ask me about these guys all the time. Now, the feeling I get is that J.P. Crawford, let me put it this way, I still think both of them have a good shot to be called up in September, but I would not be surprised at all if Crawford is not called up before the end of the season. You look at his numbers in AAA, he hasn't exactly warranted the promotion at this point. His OPS is around 680. He's hit a lot better in his last 40 games, but he's still one of the youngest players in AAA. They're in a pennant race right now. So reading between the lines, Klintak said yesterday, there is a lot of developmental value in some young players going through a postseason run, even if it is in AAA and not getting big league experience. So, again, I think Thompson is, if I had to put money on it right now, I'd say Jake Thompson is going to get promoted. Not so sure about Nick Williams and J.P. Crawford. Crawford's numbers aren't that good. I think Nick Williams, they like to see him cut down the strikeouts a little bit, show a little bit better plate discipline, maybe walk a little bit more. So those guys, while they've been okay, they haven't clearly said, you guys would be crazy not to promote me like Jake Thompson has.
Braves make a move at the deadline, maybe not as many moves as we would have anticipated, but I guess an important rule, because we had talked about it, I think, multiple times on this, the fact that you believed and were sold on the fact that Oliveira was never going to make it back up to the major league club. So one way or another, they had to deal with him. And at the end, they're able to deal him away and get something back. And what they get back is a guy that used to be an MVP type player. Now, it's been a little bit since Matt Kemp was that, but still a productive player and a guy who is kind of a neat fit for this Braves team, because I guess he grew up as a Braves fan. And, you know, you think of Matt Kemp, and I think of him, and I think, oh, he's kind of on the downhill side of the career, but he's not that old. I wonder how much is left in the tank. Did you like this move to bring in Matt Kemp to the Braves?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, let's put it this way. Had they kept Oliveira, they were just going to basically eat $28.5 million or end up packaging him in another deal where he wouldn't have provided any value. They probably would have ended up actually getting less in return because they were asking for another team to assume his salary. So to get Matt Kemp, you know, are they taking a gamble on Matt Kemp? Sure. Sure. It basically, over the next 3 years, they'll be paying an average of $8.5 million per season than they would have had they kept Oliveira. Here's a guy who, he provides the right-handed pop this team doesn't have. He's hit more home runs than Freddie Freeman over the last 2 years. People have talked about his strikeout rate, but his strikeout rate is basically exactly the same as Freeman's. With that being said, injuries have taken a toll on Matt Kemp. He's not the defender he once was. They're going to have to figure out exactly how much time they're going to give him in left field, how many days off here and there that he's going to need. Moving forward, I think Freeman said it best. At least, you know, the players are getting some indication that after saying goodbye to so many players, that the team is at least trying to add pieces now. Look, Matt Kemp may not be the most significant piece that they add between now and the start of 2017, but he at least provides a base there in the middle of the lineup for them to build around.
Does he strike you as the kind of guy that's going to be a nice fit for, as these young players come up, a guy that can kind of welcome them and be a good guy in that clubhouse?
I think so, yes. From what I've seen the first 2 days, look, everyone's happy their first 2 days anywhere. It's a new beginning for Matt Kemp. It's an opportunity to join the team that he grew up following there in Oklahoma. You know, he had the opportunity to meet Hank Aaron the other day. You know, talk to Tom Glavine, a guy that he watched the other day when he was coming home from school there in Oklahoma. This is a good honeymoon period. I think what's going to help is if the Braves can win a little bit more consistently here down the stretch. Nobody's happy, you know, in the environment that that the Braves have created with as much losing as they have experienced over the last couple of years. So that will help, but at the same time, yeah, I see a guy who can come in here and be a positive influence on the younger players. He's come in with a good attitude. He's smiling. Everyone in the clubhouse seems to have welcomed him with open arms. So we'll see moving forward exactly how it all plays out. But for right now, it does seem like he does bring a positive attitude to the clubhouse.
So that was the move that the team did make. The moves they didn't make, Nick Markakis is still a Brave. Jim Johnson's still a Brave, which to me is the most surprising thing, especially because of how well he's been pitching lately. Actually, the National League Pitcher of the Week last week, he saved four games. Did you think by the end of Monday Jim Johnson would be on a different roster?
I did. I did think that Johnson would be gone. I thought the Rangers, the Mets, there were a couple other teams that were looking for relief help. I thought that he'd be gone. And look, there was interest. The Braves basically weighed that interest, said it wasn't exactly what they were looking for. There's a chance that Jim Johnson gets moved in August. Look, the Braves aren't going to come out here and say this because, I think part of their reasoning for not moving him is they traded him and Luis Avalon at the end of July last year and basically dealt with disaster, you know, over the final 2 months because their bullpen was so thin. I don't think that you should ever, you know, keep a guy just to get to 60 wins instead of 55. I mean, what's the difference? But at the same time, I think that their thought was, hey, look, we'll keep him around a couple more weeks, you know, provide some stability. Maybe this guy, you know, comes back. Now all of a sudden, you know, if he can come back near the end of August, maybe you deal Jim Johnson at that point in time. You weren't going to get a lot in return for him here at the end of July. I get it. You know, if you're only giving him up for a month, you're not going to get much in return as well. But at the same time, I think that when they were weighing what they were getting in return, they were saying, hey, look, it may be worth keeping him around to help us win a couple games over the next couple weeks.
You mentioned maybe a waiver move for Johnson. Anybody else on that roster that could be involved in an August trade?
I'd say that Nick Markakis still is intriguing to me, you know, from that perspective. He doesn't hit home runs, you know, as consistently as he did in the past. But if you look at his ratio over the last month or two, he's had a few balls leave the park. He has consistently hit doubles this year, so there is a little bit more pop in that bat than there was last year. Everyone knows that Nick Markakis is a great guy to have in your clubhouse. He's not the fielder he once was. But at the same time, the one team, and I mentioned this last week, is you always wonder if the Orioles are going to come calling. That's the one team I kind of expected on Monday. Maybe they would have struck a deal. But at the same time, they're not the only team that they could come looking for Markakis. And the Braves do have a need probably to move either Markakis or Ender Inciarte before start of the 2017 season, because you're looking at a logjam there in the outfield now because you've got Malik Smith coming back. My thought is, you know, it'd be best to move Markakis. You may have to eat some of that salary, but at the same time, if you put Ender Inciarte maybe in, if you put him in right field, you know, you're losing a great center fielder. At the same time, you know, Malik has the potential to develop into one. The other thing you could do is, you know, I don't know if Matt Kemp can play right field on a consistent basis anymore. Maybe he's not the guy maybe you want out there, but at the same time, that's also an option. So where you have Malik Smith play left and Kemp, they, for one way or another, they do have to move an outfielder, I think, before the start of 2017. So while Markakis is an option for August, it's if it doesn't happen, I think that we'll be hearing a lot of his name or NC Arte's name possibly during the offseason. But when you look at NC Arte, you've seen what he's done the last couple of weeks. He's starting to show his offensive potential. He's going to be a top Gold Glove candidate this year. You got him for, under control for the next 4 years. And I think it would be a mistake to move him at this point in time.
Joe, the trade deadline is behind us now, and the Marlins, I guess you could say they did what they had to do in that they added starting pitching. They had obviously already added bullpen help earlier in the season. They didn't add as much starting pitching as they had hoped, even though they thought they had, I guess. We'll get into that a little bit, but let's start with Andrew Cashner. He was the big piece they get from the Padres, made his debut on Sunday, and I thought looked pretty good on Sunday. A solid outing for the Marlins in that one. What did you see from Cashner, and how does he feel about pitching without a beard?
Well, the pitching without a beard, I think he said weird, and he had a little blood, you know, had some little nicks and maybe some toilet paper on the face type of look. But, he gave them what they were looking for. I mean, it was a tough to fully measure him based on that start, considering making that quick travel, like Manley kind of pointed out, 1 o'clock Sunday game, his body clock's probably like 10 o'clock Pacific time. But, you know, what he brings to the Marlins is a power arm and a guy with top of the rotation stuff who hasn't pitched at that level as, earlier in the season in San Diego. But Cashner is going to be counted on as obviously he's a rental who's, you know, pitching for a lot. You know, he's pitching to go to the postseason. He's pitching, you know, to impress as he hits free agency. I don't think he necessarily should be part of the Marlins' plans next year, but you never know. But in the short term, power arm and someone that goes right at the top of the rotation with Jose and Connelly.
He's obviously been around for a while now and in San Diego, and they've never really been good in his time in San Diego. Joe, has he talked about getting the chance to kind of finally pitch in a pennant race?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's kind of an unknown. You could kind of look at it two ways. And, speaking to Marlins people, you could look and say, one, you know, ideally you may want a guy who's been there, who knows what it's about. And two, there's always some question of, you know, when you get, you know, players who haven't performed in the spotlight and the intensity of a pennant race. And so they did their research, and they're banking that Andrew has enough to prove and that he will shine in the spotlight instead of, kind of wilt under it. So, all things considered, when you look at, you know, where they came in, and obviously we know the rank of them as an organization, the Marlins, in terms of their organizational depth, I thought they kind of did about as well as you could expect because they didn't have the upper, you know, prospects to go after, you know, the Matt Moores and some of the other more controllable, you know, more coveted pitchers on the market. But they certainly had enough and enough history with San Diego to swing that deal and bring Cashner in. And, if they get to the postseason, it promises that he will have played a big part in that.
And they also got Colin Ray in that deal as well, but he makes one start and he leaves with an injury. And the Marlins able to send him back to San Diego and get Luis Castillo back from San Diego. Joe, I don't think I've ever seen this before. A weird situation. I think it's something San Diego didn't have to do, right? I mean, what went into the?
Well, we don't know the full story.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
There could have been potential grievances or pressure from the league, they felt something was justified to get him back. I think what kind of stood out was when Ray post game noted that he didn't feel, you know, he felt something in warm ups and even in his most recent start. But correct, medicals were exchanged and the Marlins certainly were aware that he was shut down late last season, and you know they were aware enough, but and still you know confident enough to make this trade. And as you spoke in the introduction to this, you know, the Marlins were hoping they had two starters, and they felt they did, which would address two needs. And you know, losing Ray is very unfortunate. And as you noted, I can't recall a situation where you've seen deals fall through because of medicals, but you don't really ever see someone
actually wear the uniform, appear in a game, and then kind of they look at the receipt and they see there's time to make an exchange. So, you know, they kind of undid two parts of that 7-part deal on the last Friday. And yeah, it's kind of unprecedented and certainly unpredictable. And the bottom line is the Marlins, did not address that second starter need. And, you know, Ray goes back to San Diego, and the Marlins have to make an alteration and you know, put David Phelps, who's going from their bullpen, to their rotation now. And we'll see how that plays out, because that kind of hurts their bullpen and depth, if nothing else, as well. So, they're kind of addressing the need and kind of weakening themselves in depth in another area.
Yeah, so Phelps moves to the rotation after making 50 appearances out of the bullpen. Obviously, he's a guy who has started in the past, but not this season. So how long does it take to kind of build him up into a starter again, Joe? I imagine there'll be pitch counts along the way here as he works out and lengthens himself out innings-wise.
Yeah, I think you're looking at 70 pitches maximum, or right in that neighborhood for him on Friday at Colorado. And that's only because people may not recall, but when Ray came out of the game, Phelps entered and, inherited one out and no one on in the fourth inning. And he went 2 2/3, and he actually was the winning pitcher for Miami that day. Phelps, he got stretched out of 55 pitches in that start, and kind of the rule of thumb is he had 15. My concern with David is he's been very effective in the one inning and maybe the one plus, but not really more than two. His velocity is up to 97, but I'm also mindful last August he had a season end with a stress fracture in his right forearm. Now, he's been healthy and strong this year, but that is, you come out and just let it rip for one inning. How's he going to do? And it also means he's got to change a little bit. You know, as a reliever, you can get by with cutters and fastballs and a slider or so, or with him actually it's a sinker. He'll probably have to bring out his changeup and his curveball more, because those as a starter you're going to need four pitches compared to you can get away with two pitches throwing out one inning in a bullpen.
What is it about the Subway Series, and it's the 4-game set? They're switching ballparks halfway through. Sweetie, what makes this so special?
You have two very passionate fan bases, and regardless of how the teams are doing, I think you can tell that they want to come out and see them. I mean, I hear all the time people say they're tired of the Subway Series, but when you look up, there's still full houses in the ballparks, or close to it pretty much every time. So until you start seeing half the stands full, I won't believe people saying that they're tired of the Subway Series, unless they're from like California.
Yeah, I was actually just talking to someone about this a couple hours ago. These games tend to be good. They tend to be close, tight, competitive games. And like you said, it doesn't really matter which team is heading in which direction and where they are in the standings. They always seem to be good games, whether it's a walk-off that we've seen multiple times in the Subway Series, or Luis Castillo always comes to mind as one of those games that you remember. But even last night, a 10-inning game on a sacrifice fly, it's exciting. They're close games. You don't see blowouts from there.
And I think the one thing we noticed is that both teams don't have to be in contention at the World Series. All you need is one team that needs to win games, and the other team's fan base wants to stop that from happening. So, like last year, these two teams met in September, and the Mets were going where they were going. I don't think the Yankee fans felt like the games had a less meaning because you wanted to kind of beat the team or slow down the team that was going on their own.
Bragging rights is the basis for this whole thing in a lot of ways.
And it's interesting right now because you look at the records, almost identical, but when trade deadline comes around, the Mets are buyers, the Yankees are sellers, which still, the day after, just feels a little weird to say Yankees are sellers. But I think at this point they're still in the wild card race. We'll see what can happen. But when you look at this series as a whole, these four games, does it mean more to the Mets or the Yankees? We'll start with the Mets.
I think it has to be more for the Mets, only because they're publicly going for it. They're all in. They traded for Jay Bruce and even a smaller deal for John Neese. And I agree with you. I think the Yankees can still get hot, can still make a run, even though they traded away some of their better players. It's possible. But for the Mets, it's what they're aiming to do. They're not looking to the future. They're not even looking to 2017 at this point. They're looking right now, these final 2 months, and making a similar type of run that they did last year. So if they wind up falling flat and losing 3 or 4 to the Yankees, yeah, that's more of a problem, I would say, for them than for a Yankees team that is okay as a Raptors head around the concept of maybe not winning.
Yeah, and listen, I think the Yankees have clearly, you know, laid out their plan that it's not going to be about 2016. They're talking about the future. They're talking about making some more moves when they get back to the American League ballpark with DH, and, you know, maybe shuffle the roster again. Gary Sanchez could be on his way very soon. One of their top prospects, good hitting catcher that they have at AAA. You've got other guys that you've been hearing about for a while, like Aaron Judge. Tyler Austin is having a good year for his face at AAA. You know, these are the types of guys you're going to start to see with those, you know, those at-bats coming at the expense of a guy like Alex Rodriguez. So this is not the Yankees you got used to. I've heard a lot of people say, they're sellers for the first time since 1989. They traded Ricky Henderson. They didn't trade Don Mattingly. They didn't trade, you know, everybody else. They traded one player. Got that, you know. This is the first time the Yankees have been sellers to this degree ever.
And it's funny you say that about the prospects coming in, because the Mets are kind of doing the opposite. They turned over their clubhouse to 4 new players. They shipped out Brandon Nimmo, who they still think is a huge part of their future, to bring in a utility man in Ty Kelly, because they want those at-bats now. They want those professional at-bats. They want to know what they're getting in a pennant race. You need to bring someone up in the eighth inning of the game to get a hit.
Well, plus, you know, taking a page from not just the Yankees' book, but from a contending team's book, all last winter we heard Dilson Herrera's name as the guy who... But this is the guy who's going to step in at second base. This is why you can afford to let Daniel Murphy walk, because you're going to stop gap, and here comes Dilson Herrera. He's not going to be traded. He's not going to be traded. Guess what? Yesterday he was traded. So a little different perspective than we're used to seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. And believe me, they didn't love the idea of trading Dilson Herrera, but it's something you're willing to do. These are the sacrifices you make when you want to go for it and you want to be in that
You have
mode.
A window.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can tell we're at Citi Field, by the way. I'm sure you can hear the planes overhead. Nothing we can do about that. We couldn't pause the flight patterns for this thing. But we talked about the Yankees selling, and I feel like one of the reasons they've always been buy, we're never going to rebuild, we're not a team that rebuilds, is that they didn't think the fans would accept that. But I feel like after yesterday, the fan base, for the most part, I think the educated fans who follow baseball know how this game works now, they're on board with this plan. They like what happened yesterday. They see what these prospects could become. They've seen what the Cubs have done with all their young players. And the fan base overall, I feel like, is okay with not a long rebuild, but hey, all right, let's maybe throw in the towel a little this year, maybe stumble early next year, and let's see these young guys start coming
up. If it works the plan where next year the Yankees are contending, the fan base, I'm sure, is okay.
Well, that's
okay
the pitch,
with that.
Right?
That's not how it works. No. I mean, I think you have to be realistic about what might happen. If you're going to rely on young players, you might stumble a little bit. And, you know, the Yankees' business model isn't necessarily built to rebuild. You're talking about a relatively new ballpark that you need to fill seats in. You know, the Cubs is they're a bad example. You know, you're going to get 30,000 people coming up to Wrigley Field no matter what type of team is out there. It's not necessarily built around a winning team. The Yankee business plan can't sustain a couple of years of this. It's more with the idea of maybe it's reloading and not rebuilding. The educated fan, yes, but if... You know, you have to be prepared for the fact the Yankees might lose 90 games if they go full bore with kids. Now, if 35,000 people are there and they're watching that, I'm sure the Yankees are fine with that. But if they're not, you know, the fan that says we're okay with it, maybe they're home watching on TV, not sitting in the stands. You have to expect that if there are problems, growing pains, so to speak, that will affect attendance, and we'll see by how much. But that's where you find out how much people are actually willing to accept.
It's hard to go in between, though, and I know because I watched it with this other team of the Mets. They never did do it. Yes, they sold off Carlos Beltran at one point. They sold R.A. Dickey for prospects. But they never went and just blew up the roster like a lot of people thought they should at the time. Well, guess what? It took 5 long years of fourth-place finishes for them to get back to where they wanted to be. I think if you could, you know, tell Sandy Alderson that was going to happen and go back and do it, he might have done it a different way, a quicker way. And yes, it would have resulted in more losses in the short term, but in the long term, it might have taken 3 years instead of 5. So it's a very tough balance to strike. You're not trying to do it the Astros way or the Phillies way or the Cubs way. You're trying to be competitive in the short term while also building that long-term juggernaut.